This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a UW-Platteville professor of Russian history joins us from Poland to talk about the Ukrainian refugee crisis. First, Russia's attack on Ukraine is more than just a military operation. There's also an information war. The Russian government is pushing out propaganda and false information about their actions in Ukraine in an attempt to cover up or justify the attacks. The Biden administration tried to combat that misinformation last week when they held a private briefing for a few dozen social media influencers in the U.S. to give them more accurate info about the conflict to share with their followers. The Washington Post obtained a recording of that briefing, which started with an introduction from White House Director of Digital Strategy, Rob Flaherty.
Obviously, we value the work you all are doing, informing your followers the ongoing events, and we recognize this is a critically important avenue in the way that the American public is finding out about the latest. So we wanted to make sure you had the latest information from us from an authoritative source. We're here to answer your questions and give you a quick overview.
We're learning more about what misinformation is out there, how it spreads, and the role social media plays. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble knowing what to believe, what to share coming out of Ukraine? Or do you go for credible information? Do you see misinformation popping up on your various social media feeds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Joshua Tucker is a professor of politics at New York University. He's director of the Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia and co-director of the Center for Social Media and Politics at NYU. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jen Schrady is an assistant professor of sociology at the Paris Institute of Political Studies. She's author of the book, The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. Jen, thanks for coming on with us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, both of you have been watching the spread of political related misinformation online and through social media. First, your overall thoughts. Let's start with you, Jen. What are you seeing? What kind of things are you watching for in the flow of mis and disinformation?
It's really spectacular, not only the amount of disinformation that's coming out over the war, but the media coverage of it as well. Not just us talking about it here, but the hyper-focus, as many have called this, a so-called TikTok war to try to counteract Russian disinformation. But what's really interesting is how this type of propaganda or disinformation really is nothing new, right? If we think about how propaganda has been used in previous wars by multiple sides, and the introduction of the Biden private conference calling in influencers. And of course, there was a Saturday Night Live skit about that as well. But, you know, if we really think about, again, how propaganda has been used, and celebrities, right? Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis during World War II, even Disney characters, etc. And so we're seeing this as a way to counteract what's happening in Russia, which is pretty profound, the amount of disinformation that continues despite cutting off social media that many Russians rely on.
Josh, I think people have looked at social media as something new when it comes to, I think, the rate at which misinformation can spread. Do you see changes in the way that the media, that, say, other governments like the United States government, is trying to keep up with them, get out ahead of them, and try to counter them?
Sure. Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things about this current conflict is, as much as we all sort of jump immediately to disinformation, and there is a ton of disinformation out there that's emanating from the Russian state authorities around the war, we've also, however, in the course of this conflict, seen the power of social media to actually spread information as well. If we go back to the days right before the invasion, the Russian government was essentially pushing out three narratives about why this invasion was justified. One of those narratives was that the Ukrainians were ruled by Nazis and drug addicts, a particularly egregious statement for a country with a Jewish president. And that these people were completely unpopular, and that as soon as Russia marched into the ground, troops would lay down their weapons and would greet them as liberators. There was also a story that was being put out as well about there being a genocide in the eastern part of the country where Russian speakers were being killed. We saw a technique that's known as pre-bunking. There's been research that's been done on this at the micro level, looking at this in labs, where you expose people to potential disinformation before they encounter it in the wild. And that's kind of what the US government tried to do by get out in front of this and say, look, the Russians are going to claim X, they're going to say they're doing Y, and then they're going to go ahead and do Z. And one of the things that's been kind of, really interesting about this is the fact that those narratives that I talked to you about that were getting so much play in the run-up to the war, you don't really hear those anymore. Now, we can talk about sort of new disinformation narratives that have emerged since then, but this kind of pre-bunking strategy, I think, on the part of the Biden administration by releasing some of this intelligence information, I think was remarkably effective. And it was also augmented by the fact that we had all these images coming out of Ukraine so quickly. So Jen talked about a lot of things, I think, that were similar to conflicts that took place decades ago or even centuries ago. But one thing that's different now is just how fast information flows from the battlefield to the rest of the world. And that makes it harder to sustain some of these particular disinformation narratives, such as that the Ukrainian troops would just fold and lay down their arms.
Jen, I know there's a lot of focus on, I guess, top-down propaganda from Putin and his closest followers. I know in your book, you make the case that a lot of information obviously is coming from maybe everyday people or organized groups of people. How much do you focus here on the top-down approach from, say, Putin and his followers to everyday people, a bottom-up type movement of social information?
Absolutely. There's so much hyper-focus on, as you said, the top-down politicians or even the platforms, pointing fingers at Putin or even Zuckerberg, right? Which are obviously really key. But what I found in my research is that really building on decades of other communication research, that really people on the ground, grassroots activists on every side are really a key part of any kind of information ecosystem. I did my research in the US where, even before Trump, and certainly into his presidency, there was a tremendous amount of grassroots, kind of mainstream conservatives, far right, even very far right preppers who were really engaged and kept this kind of really ideological information going. And, seeing reports coming out of Russia where people are outside of Russia are trying to reach their relatives and family members. And there's a lot of talk of how people on the ground in Russia as well are sharing information, not only on these larger platforms, but also specifically on Telegram and other ways that people are sharing information that really kind of digs into local communities, right? Whether it's local religious groups or community groups. And I think that's what's really missing. Sometimes we have this idea that disinformation is kind of injecting us or injecting people with information and that we're all just robots following whatever we hear. But the reality is that audiences are active and engaged, and we really need to understand how people on the ground are engaging with this information rather than thinking it'll simply stop by cutting off some of these major platforms.
We're talking about misinformation, Russia and Ukraine, and Jen Schrady is with us from the Paris Institute of Political Studies, Josh Tucker from New York University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you trust social media influencers to be credible sources? Do you agree with the Biden administration's idea to reach out to some of those influencers? What are you seeing when it comes to the spread of information, misinformation online in social media, your own social media feeds coming from Russia and the invasion of Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your observations or questions. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on Russian misinformation in Ukraine and on social media. Our guests today are New York University politics professor Josh Tucker and Paris Institute of Political Studies professor Jen Schrady. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, what you are seeing coming through your social media feed, anything striking you as inauthentic, suspicious. 800-642-1234 is the number if you'd like to join. That's 800-642-1234. Josh, this strategy from the White House of briefing TikTok influencers in particular, what do you think of that idea?
So I think it's part and parcel of thinking about disinformation in this conflict in one of three ways, right? We need to think about disinformation campaigns that are targeting the Russian population. We want to think about disinformation campaigns that are targeting the Ukrainian population, which we're going to see more and more of as the war drags on. And we think about disinformation campaigns that are targeting people in the rest of the world. So obviously, when the Biden campaign is trying to talk to TikTok influencers, this is, you know, possibly trying to reach into the Russian consciousness here, but this is mainly something that's focused on this larger question of how the sort of broader world perceives the support for the perceives the war and thinks about what the West's response should be here. So I think it's clever on the part of the Biden administration, if not inviting a little bit of mockery here, as Jen noted with the SNL skit that appeared on this. But the reality is that now people get news in a variety of different ways. And we know that whereas some people still tend to get, lots of people get news from TV, lots of people get news from Facebook, there is also a growing constituency for these kind of short form videos as a source of news. And the growth in the use of TikTok has been just exponential, right? I was looking at my notes, my lecture notes, this fall, and last year I had written, I can't believe there are 100 million people using TikTok already. And then this year when I had to update it, I had to update that to 1 billion people. Wow. So as Jen noted, right, if you want to reach public opinion, and if you think in the course that over the longer term, sustaining public support for the costly steps that are going to be, that are being taken by countries in the West right now in terms of the economic cost they're going to bear from some of these sanctions, which is the major tool that's being wielded here, building up public support for the need to take these sanctions is kind of important. And if you want to reach the public, there are a variety of different tools one can use to try to reach the public. And I think assuming that if you go only on TV, you're going to reach everybody is a mistake in the current day and era. So I give them credit for doing it, even though it's probably, even though it opens them up to a little bit of mockery.
Jen, do you have thoughts for the poor social media user who's bombarded with information and dis and misinformation whenever they go to their feed, potentially? How are we supposed to sort things out when we're just sitting down to see what's up with our friends' kittens?
Yes, as one of my students noted that, you know, they're getting exactly the kitten TikToks and then a report about the war, very meaningful, and then a makeup tutorial right after that, right? So it's tricky. The other interesting comments, a variety of comments that I've found from a number of my students, it'd be interesting to study this, is there, and these are students who are really engaged in politics, they do not want to share any information about what's happening in Ukraine because they're so worried about disinformation that they're hesitating. And if we think about really one of the goals of disinformation and Russia, that all along has been one of the outcomes and, you know, presumably the goals is to really not only put out disinformation, but really shake things up enough that people are really questioning what's happening. And so, as you mentioned, it is really challenging to try to weed through everything. More and more people are just getting their news from a variety of feeds and knowing what to trust and what not to trust. is really important. So it was very heartening to hear a lot of my students talk about how much they're now going back to traditional news outlets because of this problem with disinformation. They are certainly struck by the emotional grab of a lot of the TikTok and other videos that are coming out. But to really understand the broader context, they're going to the news media. And that's really one of the dangers of just thinking about these short form videos as a way to kind of position the war, is that we're left without a broader sense of what's happening. And we also risk the war being more presented to the broader world as a form of entertainment rather than important political news to really react to.
Josh, we have just a minute left. What are you watching for next in this global misinformation battle?
Can I just make a quick, I want to just make a quick follow-up to the point that Jen made a second ago, because you asked at the beginning of the hour, you know, what can readers do? And one of the most interesting new projects that we have going on in our research lab has been looking at the effect of what happens when people search for information online, when they're trying to figure out whether a news story is true or not. And what we found is that for false news stories, stories that are fake, when people search for news online, they're actually more likely to believe those false news stories. If they sort of follow up by like putting the headline of that false news story into Google and searching for it. And it's precisely because some of these more obscure false stories, we think, are not covered by mainstream news as much. And so what they find is other false news in there. So I just want to really emphasize to your listeners the point Jen made, that if you are going to try to check the veracity of news, simply Googling a headline or Googling a question might bring you back other false news information. So going back to sort of tried and true news sources that you know you can trust ahead of time, well-known mainstream news outlets, is a much safer strategy than simply Googling it. So I would just sort of add that as a kind of answer to your question at the beginning of the hour, but just as a follow-up to the point Jen made.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests, Joshua Tucker, professor of politics at New York University, Jen Schrady, assistant professor of sociology at the Paris Institute of Political Studies, with us for a look at Russian information during the invasion of Ukraine. This week, WPR marks 2 years of the pandemic in Wisconsin with stories about how COVID-19 has changed us in lasting ways. Before March of 2020, face masks were a rare sight outside of medical settings. Then they became charged political symbols. Now, as the CDC relaxes its guidance on when to wear them, Bridget Bowden reports that for many people, face masks are here to stay.
Before November 2020, Margaret Wilkins of Oconomowoc was a kindergarten teacher. But then she got COVID-19. Her symptoms, weakness, dizziness, fatigue, heart issues, were really scary.
I ended up never going back to school. I tried to go back to teach in January. I couldn't make it. I was so exhausted. I barely made it like a couple hours.
Wilkins decided to retire early. Now she's fully vaccinated and boosted, but she'll never forget how difficult her bout with COVID was. She says she's scared about getting it again, so she always wears a mask indoors. And she says she'll continue to wear a mask in some form or fashion for a long time, maybe forever.
Basically, every place I go, I wear a mask. And like I said, you know, I'm retired, so I don't have to really worry about right now going to work or going to a place for my job. And so if I did, I probably would wear a mask. I most likely would wear a mask.
Masking will also continue to be an important safety measure for Heidi Stino of Milwaukee. Stino and her husband run a small art business where they travel to various art fairs and events. She says they'll continue to wear masks because they just can't afford to get sick.
One of us getting sick or even having to quarantine meant we could not be out selling artwork and keeping our paying our mortgage, buying groceries.
Masks have been important for Stino's family in more ways than one. Back in 2020, they began making fabric masks as a way to keep their business afloat while many of the art fairs were canceled.
We kind of stopped counting after like 5,000.
Now they mostly wear N95 respirators. And even though she had never worn a mask before the pandemic, she thinks she'll continue to mask in public for a long time to come.
Especially like in the November, December months when like, you know, colds and flu and starts to show its face again.
Wilkins and Steno are not alone. Ajay Sethi, a population health professor at UW-Madison, says he expects to see plenty of people continuing to wear masks long into the future. In addition to COVID-19, Sethi says masks can help protect against other respiratory pathogens like rhinovirus, enterovirus, and RSV.
And if you're around somebody who's coughing or sneezing, it may not be, you know, SARS-CoV-2. It may be something else. So wearing a mask protects against all those things that spread by large droplets.
And Sethi expects to see people wearing masks in certain situations where people are in close contact with each other, like airplanes.
I think we've always understood that some situations did make us sick before, and we gutted it out, never thinking to wear a mask before COVID. Now we will. We've got this extra tool. Masks are available. People know how to source them. And it's a good idea to use them.
Patricia Tellez-Giron, a professor of family medicine at UW-Madison, remembers occasionally seeing people wearing masks before 2020 and thinking it was unusual.
I remember traveling a few years back and seeing people wearing masks at the airport and making almost even fun of them and saying, "Ooh, what is that?" Or even fearing them, like, "Oh, are they really sick?"
Now she's changed her perspective.
No, they were smart. You know, in the countries, they already have learned what we just learned.
2 years into the COVID-19 pandemic, it's still hard to know what the future looks like. But for some, that future will include wearing masks. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, a Russian history professor joins the program from Krakow, Poland, to talk about what he's seeing as millions of Ukrainian refugees escape into that country, including his parents. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, disciplined or chaotic, agreeable or argumentative, we've all got parts of our personality that we like, and some maybe not so much. Our guest shares the science behind personality and her 3-year experiment to change hers. Now, since Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, over 3 million Ukrainians have fled the country. That's today, as of today, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. It's one of the fastest developing refugee crises in recent history. Over half those refugees have gone to neighboring Poland. The population of Warsaw, Poland's capital, has increased nearly 20% since the invasion a few weeks ago. Our next guest is in Poland now, where he's helping his parents and other Ukrainian refugees get their bearings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see Europe do to help Ukrainian refugees? The U.S. is currently allowing Ukrainians who are already in the country to stay for 18 months. Should the U.S. do more? Do you have family or friends in Ukraine or fleeing Ukraine right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Andrei Ivanov is an associate professor of history at UW-Platteville. He specializes in the Soviet Union and Russia. Andrei is joining us from Krakow, Poland. Andrei, thanks a lot for making time for us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me here.
First of all, how are your parents doing now?
They're okay. They're resting. They need a lot of rest.
Can you share their story? They fled Ukraine. You were there in Poland to meet them.
Yes, they escaped out of the capital, Kyiv, right as it was being surrounded from the western side by the Russian troops. They escaped from the area in the northwest suburbs right outside of Kyiv. And it was a harrowing escape. It was a very difficult journey. and they're not young, obviously, and it's been horrible several days for them. You know, a ride, then a bus, then a refugee train, and a lot of refugee trains going west are flooded, are overwhelmed. The doors don't open because there's just so many people there. They have to wait for a train that can take them in. Then getting to the Polish border and waiting for a train or a bus across Polish border, it's been a very, very difficult and long journey for them.
I'm glad your parents are there and well now. What are you seeing? How many people are showing up in Krakow, where you are now, from Ukraine?
A lot. So Krakow is the largest Polish city that's also closest to the border. So, I mean, Warsaw is the largest city in Poland, but Krakow, among the larger cities, is the one that's closest to the Ukrainian border. And I would say at least 1 million Ukrainians have either passed through Krakow or had stayed here or stayed in the area. So I hear Ukrainian on the streets everywhere. I see Ukrainian people everywhere in Krakow, and it's sort of the city on essentially that's doing most of the processing and welcoming of Ukrainians coming through Przemysl, the town on the border, and then going to other locations in Europe.
This is one of the biggest surges of refugees that I could find at fastest in recent memory. What is life like for Ukrainians in Krakow right now?
They're trying to find place to sleep. It's been very hard. I've talked to some colleagues at Jagiellonian University today. I was giving a lecture at the university. And this is really, really sad. I went to a bus station and people are sleeping on the floor and it's not heated. And then there's a train station here in Krakow that's an old building of the train station. And in the basement, they just set up mattresses and people sleeping on floors in mattresses. It's very hard to find housing. You know, the city of Krakow is 779,000 people. When you have 1 million people coming through Krakow and look for temporary housing or permanent housing, this is very difficult. But the Polish people are very welcoming and they are opening up their homes and they're opening up their hearts and they're helping and they're feeding. And the students at the university in Krakow here are very active in volunteer work, in help, in finding clothing. A lot of stores, I see things, basic things, pharmacies are empty because they are trying to buy up materials, you know, or medications for the refugees who couldn't take them with them. If you have only an hour to pack up your bags and leave your home, my parents had about a couple hours to leave. What are you going to take? Well, if you forget medication you're taking or something else or some warm clothing, you have to get it here now because you can't go back home. So the volunteers in Krakow are helping the refugees here in every way they can. There's a lot of mobilization of resources here on the ground, and I'm very impressed. Poland is not a wealthy country. It is relatively, it's relatively okay, but it's not a wealthy country, and they've been pouring their hearts out helping people here.
You mentioned things left behind. I know there have been concerns where some borders require vaccine requirements, a lot of other kinds of documentation. If you left, say, an apartment building just before it was shelled, you might not have grabbed that and you can't go back and get it. Are you seeing problems with any kind of documentation for people as they've had to flee, as you said, on very short notice?
Yes. Yeah, so people who are coming to Poland or any EU country are not required to show vaccination records if they have lost it or they cannot access the Ukrainian health system database to access their vaccination records. They're not required to show it. I was in Krakow airport today and I talked to some airline workers and they're saying that they are asking Ukrainians who are trying to make it to the United States. And if they're not accompanied by U.S. citizens, they have to show vaccination papers in order to enter the United States, even if they have U.S. visas, U.S. non-immigrant visas. So the airport workers are asking Ukrainians coming to the United States to show their vaccination papers because the United States has not waived that requirement, unlike Canada. Canada has waived the vaccination requirement for Ukrainians fleeing to Canada completely, but not United States at the moment. Although there is a sort of a waiver for Ukrainians who are accompanied by U.S. citizens and they have lost their vaccination papers or whatever, they can come in to the United States without that certificate of proof. Yeah.
We're talking to Andrei Ivanov, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville. Right now, he's in Krakow, Poland. His parents are refugees from Ukraine. He's met them there, talking to other refugees as well. You could join in if you have a question for Andrei. If you have contacts in Ukraine yourself, people you're worried about, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on what you want to see the U.S. and Europe do to help refugees from Ukraine? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Andrei, I assume people kind of are maybe in a state of shock a little bit of having to flee so quickly. That said, what are people saying about the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
People are very shocked by it, the intensity of it and the brutality. People just do not understand what is Putin trying to achieve by invading Ukraine and bringing such a horrible civilian toll and so much destruction. People just don't understand. It's kind of, people are in a state of shock. It's very hard to sort of rationalize this on many levels. And it's something that also, I should say, was unexpected for a lot of people. It was completely unexpected. The scope, the scale of it, and also the reasons are completely, people are asking, what in the world does Putin want? And why, you know, why is this happening?
As a historian now of Russia and the Soviet Union, from what in Russia's history do you point toward as context to try to help make sense of this invasion?
Well, there are not as many parallels, but we have in 20th century, for example, there were examples when Soviet Union would invade a country that was getting out of line. For example, Hungary, 1956, the Soviet army invaded Hungary and pounded Budapest, and Imre Nagy, the leader of Hungary, was hoping for the support from the West, was hoping for the support from Britain and France. And the Europeans were at that point involved in the Suez Canal fiasco. And so there was no help coming from the West, and Hungarians pleaded, and there were Hungarian refugees going out to Austria and Western Europe and so on. So there's one sort of parallel here that we see, but there are other, of course, examples like that. This is what a lot of historians would say, sort of Russia's show of muscle or flexing muscle to kind of demonstrate that they have a claim to a certain area in Eastern Europe that where their geopolitical interests must reign supreme. So, historically speaking, there are some parallels, but they're not sort of the best parallels out there.
Andrei Ivanov is with us, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville, specializing in the former Soviet Union and Russia. Right now, he's joining us from Krakow, Poland, to talk about Ukrainian refugees, including his parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the international community should handle a refugee crisis like this? What, if anything, do you want to see the U.S. do to help? What do you want to know about what's going on in Ukraine right now and the flow of refugees into Poland? And do you have a personal connection with Ukraine yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Andrei Ivanov, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville, specializing in the Soviet Union and Russia. Andrei's joining us right now from Krakow, Poland, where he's involved with efforts to help Ukrainian refugees coming into the city, including his own parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about Ukrainian refugees, what life is like for them in Poland right now. If you have people you're concerned about in Ukraine, let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrei, could you talk about your your decision to go to Poland to try to meet up with your parents as they made this effort to cross the border? What was that like?
Well, it was it wasn't difficult, of course, buying tickets and flying into Poland logistically. That's fairly easy. There's a nonstop flight from Chicago to Warsaw, thanks to LOT Polish Airlines. But my parents are not young, as I mentioned, and they have my father has a pacemaker and so on, and they need help. So I realized I need to come in here and help them and logistically and look after the housing situation and so on. I also have colleagues at the university here in Krakow, at Jagiellonian University, and I wanted to come here and do as much as I can to help or coordinate or find out what the needs are. So when I go back to Wisconsin, I can tell people who are interested about those needs. And so that's the efforts overall. I mean, I'm not the only one here. I've met countless other Americans who are here helping their relatives, their family members, their friends coming in from Ukraine. Canadians too. I've met Canadians as well. I've met people who are parts of humanitarian groups. They are distributing aid. They're helping setting up camps on the border. They're involved in all kinds of outreach and health, or I should say medical help and so on. So I'm sort of part of this larger wave of people that have been coming to Poland in the recent days and trying to connect to refugees coming across the border.
If people are listening and want to do something to help from where you're sitting, what are the best ways for somebody, say, in Wisconsin to help?
Well, one thing is to contact well-known organizations that if we want to start with people who have no connections to, let's say, Ukrainian diaspora in the United States at all, then there are a number of organizations, including Red Cross, including Caritas, who do excellent work in terms of helping refugees and helping people fleeing Ukraine in general. Of course, one of the best ways to help is so-called people-to-people networks. And those networks are usually found in Ukrainian diaspora or sometimes also Polish diaspora, local churches, local organizations, local cultural venues that have connections. So if, let's say, you have a Ukrainian or Eastern European organization in your area, or a church in your area, they would be most likely already connected to somebody here on the ground in Poland or somebody there on the ground in Ukraine. There's a lot of people-to-people help that's going on. And so there are a number of ways to get involved, from helping well-known international organizations that do provide help to refugees, like Caritas and Rescue Committee and Red Cross, to local organizations or people-to-people networks that do work, carry out work sort of every day and go there and so on. And I should say, on the plane flying from Chicago to Warsaw, I met a lot of those people who are doing people-to-people sort of work. They've had somebody in their neighborhood give them supplies or medical help or money, and they're bringing that over to Ukraine or to Ukrainian border right now, because they know some people and they're sort of it's within there, or they have relatives and so on. So there's a lot of outreach going on right now. So there is actually several ways to help, and also to write to legislators to bring this more to the attention of U.S. government and whatever humanitarian and refugee legal status and processing that needs to be done from the side of the United States side. That also is something that's very important that people could get involved with.
Andrei Ivanov is with us, associate professor of history at UW-Platteville in Krakow, Poland, now working with, talking to refugees from Ukraine, including his parents. Andrei, even if the war ended somehow tomorrow, there's still a lot of destruction in Ukraine. What are people thinking about as they think about their hopes to move back home?
Well, a majority of people that I talk to want to move back to their homes. They do not want to sleep on the floor of Krakow underground train station with rats and no heating. That's pretty much the majority of people want to go back to their homes. As soon as the war is over, people will look forward to that. Now, the homes that they will see are going to be different from the homes before the war. And so Ukraine will need help with rebuilding and reconstruction. The refugee waves that EU is facing right now, or Europe is facing right now, is really the largest wave since 1945. And if Ukraine is going to have the kind of destruction that Europe had after 1945, it's going to take several years to rebuild, and it's going to take efforts similar to Marshall Plan to rebuild and bring Ukraine back, or make Ukraine help Ukraine rebuild itself and bring itself back from the ashes. It's really we don't know how long this war is going to last. The longer it lasts, the more destruction will take place.
Are Ukrainians in Poland right now able to stay in contact with friends, family who are still in Ukraine?
Yes, and a number of European mobile operators and Ukrainian mobile operators have waived roaming fees. And so there's actually an opportunity to call Ukrainians in Poland from Ukraine or from other countries, and the other way around, call to Ukraine. There's a lot of communication going on, and mobile work networks make that easier, and a lot of mobile operators are financially waiving roaming fees and various other access fees for calling to call Ukraine.
Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Yeah, I was just curious if there was, if I have an extra room in my house, there was a way to actually house a Ukrainian, house a Ukrainian family.
John, thanks for the call. Andre, I don't know if we're far enough along the process here. If people like John wanted to offer up a room to Ukrainian refugees in the U.S., do you know if there's ways to do that yet?
I don't know, but this is, thank you, John. This is a very generous offer. If the United States is going to start the process of admitting Ukrainian refugees, this is, of course, always takes time. Canada has sped up the process by offering Ukrainians temporary resident visas. But if the United States is going to open up and bring refugees in a similar manner as, let's say some refugees from Afghanistan were airlifted. If, let's say, something like this happens, then yes, there will be plenty of opportunities for folks to open up their homes. Right now, there is, of course, the ocean that separates the continents. In Poland, the situation is different. And so what John is doing right now, offering his room, is what millions of Polish people are doing right now, offering their rooms in their apartments, in their homes, in their vacation homes or whatever. They're offering their rooms. Hotels are offering their rooms to Ukrainians. And the country has taken in, I would say, at least half, if not more, of the entire refugee flow into Europe. So Polish people are doing exactly what John has offered right now. They are saying, please come on in, family, you know, stay with us. And we have a room available. And so that is something that's amazing that I'm seeing in Poland here. And once there is a refugee resettlement program or something like this with the United States government facilitating something like this, yes, then it would be possible to open up homes. I should also mention that the United States does have a smaller program for refugees from Ukraine and former Soviet Union known as Lautenberg or Arlen-Specter Amendment, and that needs to be reauthorized by the Congress every year. And that brings a few thousands of refugees from Ukraine every year. But that program has a very good sort of network of resettlement and support in general. Yeah.
Andre, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. Best to your parents and the other refugees you are working with.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Andre Ivanov, Associate Professor of History at UW-Platteville. He specializes in the Soviet Union and Russia. He joined us today from Krakow, Poland, where he's helping his parents and other Ukrainian refugees get their bearings. Follow more of the latest news from Ukraine online at WPR.org. We have stories from our colleagues at NPR.org. bringing us up to date on the latest events there. If you have a personal story to share, a connection with Ukraine, we'd love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Share your story with us. We could pass it on to our news team as well if you are interested in talking to them. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, there are a lot of scams out there targeting consumers, including fake discount offers, tax time traps, and a whole lot more. Find out what's out there in the world of scams and how you can avoid the con artists. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we looked at the history of a unique bit of Wisconsin culture and building design, the freestanding basement toilet. Bobby Tanzolo shared his reporting for On Milwaukee. A couple people responded to his tweets after the interview. One wrote, "I heard that on the way home. Cool story. Here I am living in a house built in 1984, wishing I had a toilet in the basement." Bobby responded, "It's never too late." And another comment, "Bought a home in December 2020, built in 1954 with a freestanding shower in the middle of the basement. Had a small circular shower curtain that'd go around it, no walls. Definitely not in a room." Well, that's a different twist. Bobby is still looking for your stories about freestanding basement plumbing, and so are we. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.